This is the ARC Energy Ideas Podcast with Peter Terzakian and Jackie Forrest, exploring trends that influence the energy business.
I'm Peter Terzakian, and welcome to the ARC Energy Ideas Podcast. It's February 8th, 2019.
And I'm Jackie Forrest, and today our topic is Canadian crude by rail, growing or slowing? And we have a special guest joining us today, James Cairns from CN. He's the Vice President of Petroleum and Chemicals. So welcome.
Thank you very much. Very happy to be here.
Yeah, welcome, James. We've got a lot to talk about. We're going to talk about the outlook for rail here in Alberta, considering the curtailments that have happened and the unfolding Venezuelan situation with the heavy oil losses from Venezuela to the Gulf Coast.
Yeah, and importantly, we're going to talk about some new business models that CN is developing, one called CanPox, and another business about moving pure bitumen. So we'll talk about the advantages of that model over what we do today, and lots of questions there, so we're excited to have James here.
Yeah. Great, look forward to that.
Okay, so first, James, maybe just give us some context to CN's business today when it comes to crude by rail. How does it compare to other commodities and just all the movements of rail in Canada that CN moves?
Yeah, so crude by rail, as much as very topical and you know, kind of in the news, particularly in Alberta, it's a very small part of what we do at CN. In scale of magnitude, it represents maybe 2% of our total carloads. It's a very important 2%. It's something that we're very encouraged to see the continued growth, or at least a stabilization of that crude volume. But still, big picture, small part of what we do.
Well, that's interesting, because I often hear people say to me, oh, could crude by rail increase because there must be constraints at some point with tracks and things like that. But, you know, being that it's such a small part of the total, it makes me think that probably there's a lot of capacity there when you just think about the tracks and the infrastructure from that perspective.
Yeah, so we treat all of our commodities the same. So if you look at, you know, how crude by rail fits in, when we first had the startup of crude by rail several years ago, it kind of grew to a certain level and then just completely disappeared, you know, as the price crashed. When we got back into crude by rail late last year, we were very cautious to make sure that we built up enough capacity, hired people, bought locomotives, and did the required track infrastructure so that we could manage the crude by rail demand along with all of our other existing businesses. We're not in the in the job of making trade-offs. Our job is to move everybody's freight.
Mm-hmm. Just out of curiosity, I think our audience would be interested to know, if crude by rail is only 2%, what's the biggest commodity that you move?
Well, by far, grain.
Grain.
By far.
Yeah. And is the shipping hauling of coal going down?
Coal's been a very good news story for CN. We're quite lucky in the infrastructure or the geography that we serve. You know, a lot of, there's still very strong demand for metallurgical coal, and we're going to see some new coal mines come on stream on CN's network here in the short term.
Mm-hmm. So that's interesting that while coal is reviled, it's actually still a commodity that is very much needed and is being shipped.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Okay, let's talk about crude by rail. So as you said, business had kind of trailed off a bit, but over the last year, we've seen almost a twofold increase. And the NEB just released 330,000 barrels of crude by rail moving in November of 2018.
Yep.
So can you tell us, where is this crude mostly going? And we think of you as a Canadian railroad,
right?
But can you take this on your own network to the U.S.?
Absolutely. The biggest market for crude by rail coming out of Canada is the U.S. Gulf Coast. I think the economics seem to work, and the ARB seems to be such that people want to move to the Gulf Coast, or had wanted to move to the Gulf Coast. CN's rail network, we stretch all the way across Canada from the East Coast to the West Coast and all the way down to the U.S. Gulf Coast. So we have direct routings down to New Orleans, Baton Rouge area.
Hmm. So when you say ARB, you're saying that the price difference between what the crude sells for in the Gulf Coast versus what it sells for here, there's enough gap to cover the cost of transportation.
It appears to be the case, yes.
Well, there's movements. We'll talk about that. Things changed a little bit with the curtailment. But let's talk a little bit about the curtailment. So, you know, we had very wide diffs. I think that would have covered moving crude a lot of places when we had a $50 differential between heavy oils here and light crude oil at WTI, but that has narrowed quite a bit. And CN just had an earnings release a couple of weeks ago talking about the fact they were moving 230,000 barrels a day of crude in Q4, but their expectations were there would be a little dip in Q1 due to the Alberta government production curtailment. So we've had a bit of a change in the movements of crude by rail because of the curtailment. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of discussion now that the economics aren't supportive. And of course, we had Imperial last week have some news releases talking about the fact that they don't think the economics support crude by rail. Now, we actually released a blog earlier this week at the ARC Energy mm-hmm. Research Institute. We'll put a link to it on the show notes for this show. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we look at it a different way in that, yes, of course, the narrow differentials that we have, we only have about a $10 difference between Western Canadian Select and WTI, which is very narrow. And in the past, you would have said that it's impossible to move crude by rail and make money. But mm-hmm. things have changed, and there's three factors that we argued are making things a bit better. One is that Cushing oil is deeply discounted compared to the Gulf Coast.
That's in Oklahoma.
That's in Oklahoma. So, you know, inland crudes, including in Alberta, are quite mm-hmm. low relative to the Gulf Coast. The second thing is that the heavy grades at the Gulf Coast are pricing very high relative to light crudes. Mm-hmm. You know, it used to be that a heavy crude on the Gulf Coast would sell $8 or $10 a barrel cheaper than a light crude.
Right.
Today, they're maybe a dollar or two apart, depending on the grade. And then the third thing is that there is a lot of committed rail shippers, people that have signed up to move crude by rail, right. and there's some sunk cost there
right.
that going forward, they may still choose to move even in a scenario where they don't cover the full costs of transportation.
Yeah, yeah.
And so we argued that you're going to still see some crude by rail movements, even though we heard from Imperial that they're not moving their crude by rail, and their economics may be different. But in general, we argued there should still be some movements, especially when you consider the huge demand for heavy crude now with the situation in Venezuela.
Right. So we're definitely being impacted by the curtailment or the shutdown of crude by rail by Exxon. Most of our other customers are still shipping. There has been, some impact and some kind of gauging what the market might look like, and that has been affecting our volume. But, you know, we are still very, very bullish on crude by rail, and we think that when the curtailment situation gets sorted out and we have a kind of a leveling off of that arb, that, you know, we'll be right back to where we expected to be for crude by rail in 2019.
Right. And we're not, the important part, you can go look at the write-up, is that we're not too far off, actually, competitive
right.
economics right now. Yeah, they are a little too narrow, maybe between
mm-hmm.
$2 to $6 per barrel. It needs to widen out to support
right.
crude by rail. But mm-hmm. then when you think about the committed rail shippers, you know, they may still make that choice to move. And maybe it's worth talking about that. You know, in the past crude by rail era, in 2012-13, there wasn't as many of these committed shippers.
Correct.
Now there are. So what's the difference between a committed shipper and someone who's just moving more on a spot basis?
Yeah. So, you know, as I said before, we were very cautious to make sure we built the infrastructure required to move the crude by rail and fit the demand. So associated with that, we did separate contracts. You know, over term, typically we're looking for a three-year term for these crude deals. And they require a commitment to move or a shortfall penalty be paid. And that way we can justify the capital investment, hire the crews, go and get the locomotives. That's very different than the first time that crude by rail came up, which was more characterized kind of as a spot business. I've got a unit train today, you know, CN, can you move my unit train? It's a very different model mm-hmm. that we're using now.
So unit train, just to be clear, is basically all dedicated, like, what is it, 100, 110 cars that are all tanker cars?
Yeah, that's correct, Peter.
So it's like a pipeline on wheels.
That's correct, yes.
Yeah, and mm-hmm. that model is much more efficient. It's like a nonstop flight, or it's not a flight, but, you know, nonstop from Alberta to a refinery somewhere in the Gulf Coast.
That's right. Right. It's like getting on the express bus as opposed to the milk run bus. Correct.
Right, yeah. Right. And so when you realize that sort of commitment from shippers, mm-hmm. that yields economies of scale and the costs go down and you become more competitive with pipe. Is that?
That's correct. Yeah. Rail is still more expensive than pipe, clearly. And I think that's the nature of the product that moves by rail as opposed to the, you know, pure rail economics.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully we'll talk about that a bit when we get into the whole notion of dilbit and
mm-hmm.
Versus bitumen.
Yeah.
We talked about the contracted model is sort of the main model today.
Right.
I think it's important to talk a little bit about what that means. So when someone has contracted rail, they do have a lot of sunk costs, even if they choose not to move crude by rail, right?
Yes.
They've committed to some cost for rail cars and some cost to the railway.
Mm-hmm.
And so my argument was that, you know, for many producers, the go-forward economics look quite different now that you mm-hmm. have contracted rail, because you're only looking at the incremental money you have to spend. And so it may mean that crude by rail movements are, you know, more consistent and more constant over the next 2 to 3 years because of those commitments that have been made.
Yeah, it's interesting to follow the evolution of what's happened over the last 8 years or so. In 2011, 2012, we had some fairly big differentials. There was capital allocated to build out loading and unloading terminals, but it didn't quite completely catalyzed into the contracting model back then.
Exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
So it was the supply chain of rail was not fully developed. With the most recent big wide differentials, all of a sudden, it really pushed producers, refiners to contract long term. We already had built out in 8 years ago the loading and unloading terminals. So now it is a full alternative supply chain to pipe.
Yeah, it's a much more robust and much more reliable supply chain than it was in the past, for sure. And if you think about what you might call sunk cost, Jackie, probably about 50% of that cost of getting crude oil down to the U.S. Gulf Coast is kind of sunk and committed. Mm-hmm. If you look at from tankage down through loading terminal commitments, rail car commitments, rail commitments, and unloading commitments at the other end, that's probably up to half of the total cost. Mm. Recent statements made by a couple of the major oil producers here in Alberta indicate that falling costs all in move crude by rail from Alberta to the U.S. Gulf Coast is somewhere in the neighborhood of $15 to $20 a barrel.
Mm-hmm. Do you see that going down?
I do not, no.
No, it's pretty... Right.
And those are actually the numbers we ran in our write-up to sort of show the relative economics.
Yeah.
And, in that case, just to be clear,
that's $15 to $20 per barrel of dilbit. So, Peter, when you say, do I see that going down, the best way to decrease those costs and improve the economics is get the diluent out.
Right.
So let's talk about these new business models for moving bitumen by rail, because CN has done a lot of innovation in this area, and we want to really highlight to people that the perception that rail is more expensive, you know, that's true today, but that can change if we do things differently. Mm-hmm. And so you have two new businesses that you're promoting in order to make rail much lower cost than it is today.
Correct, yeah.
One is moving pure bitumen. And one is this CANPUX. So we'll get to CANPUX, which are pure bitumen wrapped in plastic that look like hockey pucks. Great Canadian symbolism to call it CANPUX.
Yeah, I'd call it more like a yogurt container. But anyway, you can play hockey with it.
Probably could.
Let's just set the context here for a minute. So further to what you were saying, James, about the dilbit, I mean, the current modality of shipping bitumen is to take the bitumen from the producer, dilute it like with a blood thinner, which is basically condensate or other light oils, to get it to a fluid enough state to put easily into a tanker car, ship it to Texas where they take the blood thinner diluent out, and then put the bitumen in the refinery. Mm-hmm. So what you were referring to as the inefficiency is that this whole process of thinning the oil and then de-thinning it at the other end.
Yeah.
And so what you're proposing is to say, well, let's not use the diluent at all.
That's right, Peter.
Which is about what, 20, 25%?
It's 30%
or more. 30% or more. And so that means you have to haul 30% less.
That's right.
Which means your costs go down by 30%.
Exactly. Right.
And I think the important thing is this whole diluent model was made because of the pipelines. You know, they can't move things down pipelines that are solid. And so, the rail is kind of taking the existing paradigm and moving that. But there, for rail cars, you don't need to be putting that diluent in.
No, we do not.
Now, it's quite solid. So it's because you need heated cars. Is that how you continue to allow the bitumen to be able to be moved in and out, considering it's so thick?
Yeah, they're coiled insulated cars. So, you know, the bitumen is loaded in hot, and by the time it gets to the destination, sometimes it has set up enough that you have to apply steam to the cars. Sometimes you're going to load it without steam being added. Yeah. We do move a lot of very heavy oil out of the Lloydminster and Lashburn area, and that's been quite successful. And if you look at kind of the undulations of crude by rail volume, that's the kind of business that stuck in the good times and the bad times. The economics proved that they could work. So even when the dilbit stopped moving by rail, you know, the heavy crudes, the API 18 type crudes, were still moving by rail and the economics still worked.
Right.
Right. And we've looked at the economics too, and it's really impactful when you think about the whole, I guess, the economic life cycle, right? If you just look at the transportation cost alone, it would show that rail is more expensive. But when you consider that oil sands operation has to pay for 30% of the barrel, they have to buy a premium product, an expensive product, put it into this heavy bitumen, and then get a product that's discounted significantly.
Right.
When you account for them not having to pay for that, this, I'll call it a diluent penalty, actually shows that the economics for moving pure bitumen in rail cars is pretty similar to moving on pipelines, especially if you're an uncommitted shipper. That's been our analysis.
Yeah, Well, I support that analysis, so thank you. I mean, we're not saying that this should replace pipe, not by any means, but I think it needs to be part of the solution. And as we get into Canapux a little later, another part of the solution. If we keep on, you know, dreaming and hoping that, you know, pipelines are going to get built, we're going to wake up tomorrow and find ourselves in the same problem. We need to look at other alternatives. Crude by rail is great. It works. But boy, oh boy, if we're going to be committed to moving crude by rail as part of the supply chain to get Alberta crudes to market, let's do it cheaper. Let's get the diluent out. Let's ship 30% less product, and let's get the cost down by 30% to get them in line with pipe.
Right.
And why aren't we doing it today if it's so efficient and we could have lower rail costs?
You know, it requires some capital expenditure. You'll have to build a diluent recovery unit. I moved to Calgary 9 years ago, and I started doing the rounds 9 years ago talking to all the oil companies about shipping crude by rail. And, you know, we talked about shipping it without diluent and what that model might look like. And, you know, we'd go through the economics and, you know, there was wide agreement that, yeah, this kind of makes sense. But the answer I got was, James, the pipeline's going to be built in 2 years. Okay. And every year for the last 9 years, interesting model, James, we get it. A little tweak here, a little tweak there, but pipe's going to be built in 2 years. And it'll take me 2 years to build the diluent recovery unit. And by that time, why would I spend that capital to match pipe economics when I can just wait for the pipe to be built?
Yeah, there's another dynamic, which is, as a producer, the response would be, well, you know what? I just spent hundreds of millions, if not billions, on the whole process for blending diluent. And so you're going to render that obsolete with this new thing. So sorry, I can't do that. I just spent all this money on this process.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But I mean, they still could use that process. And in fact, they probably need to do it to move the bitumen through the pipelines to the rail terminal.
Yeah.
But let's explain a little bit what a diluent recovery unit is in terms of the scale and the cost.
Yeah.
You know, it's effectively a very, very big crude unit. You know, in big refineries, they would have a crude unit. You'd need something of that scale, I think, depending on the volumes that we're talking about. Yeah. So it's not an insignificant cost. Is it in the hundreds of millions of dollars of investment?
I'd say it's in that range,
Yeah, and so that's been kind of a barrier. Like, you can't get a payback on that if you're only going to use it for a few years, especially because many of these same oil companies have committed to pay the pipelines when the pipelines start up.
Right.
But as you say, we've been talking about this. The pipelines are always 2 years away for the last 9 years.
Yeah.
And if we had had this in place, things would have looked a lot different last December.
It sounds like hundreds of millions sounds like a lot of money. But when you figure, you know, with these persistent differentials and the volatility and the tens of millions that are lost every day, it's really... Yeah. And so the realization has set in that, okay, we do need to diversify our transportation modality.
Yeah.
To insulate us against, first of all, even pipeline outages, refinery outages, and have the flexibility of being able to transport in a different way that actually is becoming more efficient. Is that the story?
I think so, Peter. And the big deal with crude by rail, especially if you take the diluent out, is market access. When you ship by pipe, you go to where the pipe ends. If you ship by rail, you have the opportunity to ship to the market that offers you the best netback. And if you look at what happened here when the price really collapsed this fall with that $50 differential, really the driver was the shut-in or the turnaround of some very large refineries in PADD 2. So we had all this supply coming out of Canada and a significantly decreased demand in PADD 2, our primary market. If you had the ability to ship by rail, you were in the money. Because now you're shipping to the Gulf Coast and you're getting a Mayan type price.
Right.
So hence, there was a lot of interest and a lot of demand for crude by rail when that diff was wide. And I go back to, if we believe, and it seems to be the sense of industry that crude by rail is going to be sticking around for a while, and it might vary the amount of volume that ships each year, but it's going to be part of the supply chain long term. Take out the diluent. Now you can ship cost competitively with pipeline, and you get the additional advantage that you have this market access to go to the market that offers you the best
the higher price. Right? Actually, I remember, I think maybe it was around the time I first met you several years ago, that you're also saying that the velocity, in other words, the speed at which the crude travels through rail is much faster than through pipe.
Yeah. You can get down to the Gulf Coast in about 8 days.
Versus pipe?
Well, in excess of 30 for sure.
Is that right? So you put a slug or barrels of oil in a pipeline at Hardisty near Edmonton, it takes a month to get to the Gulf Coast?
I'm not the expert on that, but that's what I've been told.
Wow. And you're 8 days.
Yeah. And I think another thing that's changed too, so there's some advantages from that, but that we've, with the last year or so when there's been such a commitment to crude by rail, the old model, the model where we still use the diluent, but people have made investments in rail cars and these long-term commitments.
Right.
And so to me, we're kind of halfway to where we need to go. We've kind of got a bunch of sunk costs now.
Yeah.
And so just, you know, a little bit more to get to the efficient rail model. So right. maybe, you know, part of the problem before was that it was such a stretch mm-hmm. and so much new commitment needed. But yeah. now that you've made this commitment for 2 or 3 years, the stretch to get from where we are today to this bitumen-only model is a little bit closer. And mm-hmm. and as you say, James, if the economics are competitive with pipe, then you don't have to worry about shutting this down the day a pipe shows up.
Right.
Like, this will
exactly.
actually still be competitive.
It'll still be competitive. So, let's talk hockey. Hockey
yes.
pucks. Can
pucks.
Can
right.
pucks.
So the can pucks is a little bit different. You know, do you imagine, first of all, what is it? Maybe explain to the listeners what can pucks are and how it works to move bitumen.
Yeah. So can pucks. So what we did with can pucks is we kind of looked at it and said, you know, in order to ship this very heavy product we have in Alberta, bitumen, API 8, 10, 12, to market, we have to change the viscosity so flow in a pipeline, right? We have to decrease the viscosity. Well, what if we could go the other way? Instead of trying to make it liquid so it'll flow, what if we made it solid? What if we found a way to ship it like coal in the existing coal supply chain using existing infrastructure? And we work with a company in Edmonton called Innotech. Very, very smart guys, engineers. They looked at 17 different ways to basically solidify bitumen. And they landed on what we think is kind of like the caramel secret here, is that we take the bitumen, we blend it with a polymer, recycled grocery mm-hmm. bags, okay? Mm-hmm. And then we take that now product that really is solid but very sticky, and we wrap it in polymer so each puck or pellet can be shipped as an individual discrete unit. If we didn't wrap it in polymer, they'd all stick together. And remember, our goal was to ship this in the existing coal supply chain. So the canapuck's form and shape and everything about the design is so it can look like coal and ship like coal. So we started this process, well, I think we started looking at probably 5 years ago now, and we finally got to the point in 2018 where we have all our patents done. We've proved out the chemistry in the lab. We've proved out the kind of industrial engineering parts of how would we build this plant and how would we scale it up and what would it look like in the port. And we're finally ready for prime time.
So it's sort of like those, like the yogurt containers coming off these high-speed food packaging plants, right?
That's exactly it, Peter. Even if you look at the machinery that will be used in order to make these, make canapucks, if you think about a yogurt cup or I like to say, think about a peanut butter. You know, when you go for breakfast and you have those little tiny peanut butter things, it's the same
like
thing.
A little bit bigger, but it looks the same. Yeah.
It's a bigger peanut butter cup, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so, and you did announce in January that you're planning to build a pilot plant for mm-hmm. $50 million is the estimated cost for 10,000 barrels a day. So that's pretty big scale. Mm-hmm. Now you're still looking for funding for that, as I understand.
Yeah, our goal at CN is not to be a midstream company. We're a railroad, and we think we do what we do very well. We're not going to be a midstreamer. So in order to really take this thing to the next level and help prove this out on a larger scale, we're willing to participate in the development of a pilot plant. So
right.
we'll be one of the partners. It'll be government, industry, and CN to build this pilot plant. And we're very lucky to have a great relationship with our friends at Wapaki Energy and the Heart Lake First Nations Band that have partnered with CN to help us, you know, bring this product forward. And we're very hopeful that we will have shovels in the ground in 2019 and have a small-scale pilot plant to prove this out at scale.
So you turn this product bitumen into much more of a benign, easily shippable in a traditional coal type hopper car.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Aluminum.
Yep.
And then it gets put on a container ship and gets shipped wherever.
Yeah. And the economics are fantastic when you get away from the tanker car and you get into the hopper car. And you said it right. It's an aluminum hopper car, significantly lighter weight. So you gain about 20 to 25% more capacity. So you can ship more product in one rail car than if you use a tank car.
And it's much safer.
Absolutely, Peter, absolutely. You know, canapucks is a very, very environmentally cautious way of moving crude oil to tidewater, right?
Mm-hmm.
They won't leach or dissolve into the environment. You know, they won't burn or explode. And best of all, they float in water.
Hmm. So you just go scoop them up. But talk about the environmental issue of, okay, you're using recycled plastic bags or whatever.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Now it gets to the customer at the other end.
Yep.
How do you separate all this out? I mean, they're all petroleum products.
Yeah, it's with heat. It's heat separation, and the polymer floats to the top, and you skim it off, and now you have your pure bitumen and you have your pure polymer. And the very interesting thing about using recycled polymers in Alberta is the value of the polymer when you get to Asia, when you get to China, is about three times the cost to produce the recycled polymer in Alberta. So this is a very, very, very compelling economic advantage of Canapux. You know, in the last couple of years, China's really cracked down on recycled polymers. Mm-hmm. They used to be the world's dumping ground for recycled polymers, and the government finally said, enough. There's too much mercury. Sure. There's too many heavy metals. We don't want to do it. If it's going to be polymer, it's either going to be virgin polymer or it's going to be certified recycled polymer. Well, guess what? We know how the polymer is produced. It's certified at origin because we blend it with the bitumen, and we separate it out. Now it's a certified polymer when it arrives in Asia. And because the cost of polymer in China, typically they're using a naphtha-type feedstock for the polymer that they buy, is more expensive than North America, the recycled polymer has a real, real strong demand, a strong pull.
So you're saying that that's a product that they can get value from. Obviously, it's going to get reused if someone's paying for it. It's not just going into a landfill somewhere.
Oh, absolutely not. No, this would be sold in the recycled polymer market, and they would make stuff from it.
I also read that Asian refiners have been responding well to this new product, and there was a memorandum of understanding in place with one Asian refiner. So how do they view this? This is quite a different paradigm from getting crude by tanker that refiners are more used to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the memorandum of understanding we have is not with a particular refiner. It's a Chinese company that wants to, you know, get involved in shipping Canapux and taking it to destination. And their response is really, we can get Canadian crudes at this price because they look at it compared to the price for Arab Heavy, and it's quite a discount. It's quite a value that's created.
And in terms of the cost for shipping, if you compare it to paradigm today we have the TMX, we can ship, we can put it on a tanker and move it to Asia in a tanker. How would this compare? Would it be competitive with that
option? Yes, it would be. When you say we can do that today, that's very, very small scale.
Yes, we have about 50,000 barrels a day or so that we can move that way.
And even when you have Trans Mountain expansion, I still think there's going to be room for Canapux. And we believe the economics of Canapux landed in Asia is going to be in line or superior to the economics of Canapux landed new build, new construction, Trans Mountain tolls.
Now, James, I know you're a railroad guy. I'm holding this Canapux, but so it lands in China. What we talked about the recycled plastic bags, but what about the bitumen inside this puck? Where does that go?
It goes to refineries.
All sorts of different petroleum products.
That's correct. Feedstock typically for teapot refineries that have coking capacity or have the capacity to, you know, blend off some of the heavy and put it through the refinery.
What about asphalt? Do they do that too?
Asphalt's a big demand for that product. It's very, very interesting when you bring up asphalt that, you know, if you think about, you know, the demand for asphalt in China, it's huge.
Yeah, they're making a lot of highways and roads.
They are. So. And our product, our Alberta product is perfect for making asphalt. They love it.
Well, you know, it's interesting what we've talked about here, where the differential issue that we had in November and December was almost like a breaking point where we forced us to think differently. And I think that is not ending. Like, we are now thinking completely differently about entrenched processes, thinking about making them more efficient, thinking about diversifying our optionality in transportation, in use of product. And I think that's really a positive thing if you look at the big picture of what's happening. We need this kind of diversification and optionality so that we're not caught in singular one-dimensional models of resource extraction, delivery, and usage.
I 100% agree, Peter. And if you think about Canapux is one way of solving that problem. DRUs, another way, diluent recovery units, another way of solving that problem. And there's a whole bunch of other great ideas out there. And I go back to, you know, if we would have had Canapux up and running, if we would have had diluent recovery units running in Alberta, we would have not seen that price collapse for Alberta crudes that we saw last fall.
Because
we would have had that market optionality. And the thrust behind Canapux, just to be clear, is to find a way to get to new markets that are not in the U.S. They're not on the Gulf Coast. It's not PADD 2.
Well, and greater value for them.
That's correct, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the key to getting the highest price is optionality.
Yes.
And Canapux and the bitumen on rail, and even the rail we have today with the Dilbit, provides that optionality. Yeah. And so the title of this podcast was, you know, crude by rail growing or slowing. I have to say growing because I do believe that the infrastructure we have in place, we're going to build on that and find more economic ways to do it and create that optionality that we just haven't had. And I think everyone understands the cost of that more today than they might have 3 or 4 months ago.
Yeah, and even further than that, I mean, every time you mention crude by rail, there's sort of a negative stigma attached to it. But I think, James, what you've demonstrated in terms of the different models that and innovations that CN is bringing to the market, that it actually, in many ways, is a positive set of flexibility and optionality that you're bringing to the market.
Absolutely, Peter.
Yeah, well,
good. Thank you, James, for joining us on the podcast today. It's been really informative.
All right, thank you very much. Thank you.
Good, and thank you, listeners. If you like this podcast, please rate us on iTunes and tell someone else about us.
Thank you very much.
For more ideas and insights, visit arcenergyinstitute.com.